Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. A West Hartford, Connecticut native is leading efforts to expand broadband access to Americans and make it more affordable. Attorney Jessica Rosenworcel has been a member of the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, for two terms. Now she's the acting chairwoman of the FCC. Today, Where We Live, we listen back to my conversation with Rosenworcel. We spoke in February. She oversees a federal independent agency that regulates communication technologies like cell phone and cable services. The pandemic has shown all of us the importance of having reliable phone and internet access. You can join our conversation. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Jessica Rosenworcel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I mentioned again, you're acting chairwoman of the FCC, and you're also a Hall High School grad. How often do you get back to our state?
Well, my parents still live in the house where I grew up. And so when I come home, very little has changed, but that's really the sweetest part. I am a Connecticut person and a New Englander at heart. So I miss being there in that part of the country. I'm in Washington right now. We're having a small snowstorm, but it's nothing like the fluffy white snow I knew growing up at home back in the 80s and 90s.
So as a member of the FCC, when I think about the issues that you and your colleagues work on, have worked on over the years, this might not be something the general public follows closely, but I think the pandemic has changed that when we see how important and necessary it is to have high-speed internet for people who are working at home, especially children who are have been in remote school now. What have you been hearing from parents and teachers, even healthcare professionals, when we think about the importance of telemedicine during the pandemic?
Yeah, you know, there probably was a time not that long ago when I would have to begin conversations explaining what the Federal Communications Commission does and how the agency's been around since 1934 and oversees satellite services, cable services, your cell phone, wireless access, and a whole bunch of engineering and technical matters. But during this pandemic, the value proposition of having access to high-speed internet service, I mean, it's just never been clearer, right? As a nation, we've been asked to take so much of what we do in person and go online for work, for school, for healthcare, and more. And I think that this pandemic has conclusively demonstrated that for every household, broadband's not just nice to have, it's need to have. And I think that that simple fact is going to have to direct the FCC's actions in the days ahead.
Just the other month, we spoke with John Horrigan from the Technology Policy Institute. He looked at the digital divide here in our state during the pandemic, and it really focused on two groups. So when we think about people in communities that don't have access to broadband or reliable service, like rural areas, Northwest Connecticut, and other parts of the Quiet Corner, but also communities where maybe service is available, but people can't afford a good plan that gives them the speed they need. So we're thinking about low-income communities of color in our Connecticut cities. So can you talk about the issues that we have in our state here in Connecticut, how that plays out in other states?
You know, I actually think the way that he described the digital divide is just right. I think for too long when we talked about the digital divide, we were only talking about rural communities, remote areas like you said, the Quiet Corner or Northwestern Connecticut, where the infrastructure may not reach every single house and every single business. And we need to spend funds and develop plans to make sure that it does, just like we've done with electricity over the history of this nation and in the state. But there's this other component to the digital divide that's really important, which is we have to think about adoption and affordability. And there's some data out there that suggests that 3 to 4 times as many households in urban and suburban areas don't have reliable and consistent access to broadband. So if we're going to solve the digital divide, get everyone everywhere connected, and I think we should, we have to address both deployment and adoption. And I think that's the way we have to think about this issue going forward.
I understand you've coined the term homework gap. And now, again, we're in this pandemic where we see how the digital divide impacts children and learning. We know that children have a right to receive a free public education. Do you see this also meaning that kids have a right to internet, good, consistent, reliable internet access too?
I'm so glad that you asked about what I call the homework gap. And the way I describe it is this, you know, when I was growing up in West Hartford, if I needed to do my nightly schoolwork, I needed paper, a pencil, and my brother leaving me alone. And, you know, that third one was the hardest part. And now every child needs internet access. Look, 7 in 10 teachers before this pandemic assigned homework that requires internet access. But all the FCC data show that there's 1 in 3 households that don't have broadband service. And where those numbers overlap is what I started calling the homework gap. And it was a crisis before the pandemic. But then, gosh, roughly a year ago, we sent 50 million kids home and we told them to go online and engage in remote learning. But you know what? Millions of kids have been locked out of the virtual classroom because they don't have that reliable internet access at home. So I have been pressing for the FCC to make solving the homework gap a priority. It feels to me that it's a very distinct part of our nation's digital divide, but it's one that we should be able to solve. There's data that suggests there's between 12 to 17 million students in this country who don't have access to the internet they need for their education. And I just feel like that's a big number, but it's not so big we can't solve it. And we should use programs that have existed for decades, like a program called E-Rate, that helps connect our schools and libraries in every state across the country. How can we update it and modernize it so it also helps provide options for those kids to get connected at home for their homework and their schoolwork?
This is something your former colleague and former chairman, Pai, did not agree on the role of these programs. And so moving forward as acting chairwoman, how do you see working with your Republican colleagues around this program, again, to make it more robust?
Well, I've got an agency that is right now has 2 Democrats and 2 Republicans. Typically, we would have 5 members. We've only got 4. So bipartisanship is the only way forward. I am keenly aware of that. But I also think we are sitting here in this extraordinary time, right? We've got this pandemic. We're trying to get out of an economic crisis associated with it. And we know that giving people access to modern communications is a way to help them continue their schooling, keep up with their medical appointments as telemedicine grows. And for many people, it's essential to really continue to go to work and to maintain their jobs. So I just feel like we have to bring those ideas to center and find a way to work on them.
Part of the problem is the data that the FCC and the federal government has related to what broadband access actually looks like across our country, the maps and who has it and who doesn't. Could you talk about this monumental challenge before you as you think about ways to improve internet access for all Americans?
Yeah, it is both really simple and a really big challenge at the same time. But it's hard to believe, but this the United States, we don't have the best maps that suggest precisely where broadband service is and is not. And during the last several years, the administration spoke a lot about fixing this. But I decided right out of the gate, as I took over the reins, we were going to actually set up the architecture to do it. So I set up a broadband data task force. And we are going to be using funds that have been appropriated to the agency to help us build nationwide maps of where service is and is not. And we're not just going to rely on the carriers telling us that. We're actually going to rely on consumers, local governments, state governments, tribal authorities. In other words, we're going to take the data we have and ask people across this country to help us perfect it and get it right. Because I think all of us know, you know, which house is too far down the road for getting service and which places when we travel, we start to lose bars on our phone. So how do we take that knowledge that we all have from our day-to-day life and make sure that that knowledge can help us in Washington build better data, build better maps. And once we have that kind of granular, precise information, we will all do a lot better job at sending support to areas that don't have service and getting them connected.
When I mentioned some of the companies that got awarded these bids, one of them is SpaceX. And so I'm wondering if you could talk about the technology available to get this internet access to, say, rural parts of our country, where, again, we know that internet service providers in the past, if it's not something that they can make money off of, they're not going to put in all the infrastructure to get that internet to somebody.
So I don't want to talk about any particular company, but I think you bring up a really good point. There's different technologies that are being developed that might be able to help us get to more places faster. You know, traditionally, we used to think about our telephone companies and they would offer digital subscriber line service. And that was how people got high-speed internet. Increasingly, most households get it through their cable provider. And we are starting to see the development of new fixed wireless services that could also change how people access the internet from home. And these low-Earth orbiting satellite systems could get connectivity to some of the hardest-to-reach places a lot faster than terrestrial on-the-ground systems. So I'm an optimist about all these different types of technology that are being developed, because I think in this country, we're going to have to use them all to reach everyone everywhere.
This is a topic that we talk about often here on Where We Live. I wanted to share some listener tweets that they were sent to me. Randy tweeted, starting January 1st, Xfinity turned back on the data cap. And that means they were getting warning emails. They were going to start getting charged per gigabyte and terabyte. My wife and I work from home. My son is 100% remote learning. Our TVs are all Wi-Fi. They had to ration the data the last 2 days of January, which can be problematic when you have to work and get your schoolwork done. Someone else tweeted, Diana, that broadband internet's something that has clearly become a basic need. We're all paying too much. And if you have Comcast, chances are it's unreliable. We upgraded to the speed recommended for an office building and saw no noticeable change except in our bill. So just with some of those tweets sent to us, Acting Chairwoman Rosenworcel, what can the FCC do to help consumers?
Well, first of all, I agree it's an essential service. Everyone needs it right now to have a fair shot in 21st century life. And with respect to data caps, I understand this not just professionally, but personally. You know, I'm in a household with kids who are doing online schooling, a spouse who's also working. And we too worry about what those data caps can mean. Now, as far as FCC authority, one of the challenges is during the last administration when they rolled back a lot of the agency's authority in this place. So we're going to have to look about what rules we have and how we might be able to reassert it. But I know that my inbox is filled with complaints about data caps. I mean, this pandemic has put a focus on it, and it's easy to see why. It's not just my household and the household of your listeners. We're all trying to do more things online and using up more capacity in the process. And while the FCC has always had policies about reasonable network management and allowing providers to make some decisions, I think we've got to acknowledge that these data caps can really harm households and individuals, because they can't do everything they need to do during this pandemic to maintain some semblance of modern life. This is an area of concern. I've asked the FCC's Enforcement Bureau to look into some reports that certain ISPs, if they're complying with their policies and how they disclose information to the public about what their plans are. And I've also reached out to the Attorney General of Pennsylvania, who's done some work on this subject. So I am studying what policies we have in place at the FCC in light of changes made during the past administration and trying to figure out a way to address this. Because, again, I understand it not just professionally, but personally. It's an issue in my household, too.
You mentioned ISPs, Internet Service Providers. When you talk about the changes in the last administration, how these Internet Service Providers are classified, I think it's Title I versus Title II, and why that difference makes why it would make a difference in terms of how to get Internet Service Providers to comply with more regulations. Acting Chairwoman, can you describe that for us?
Yeah, the last administration chose to roll back the FCC's net neutrality rules. I oppose that. I support net neutrality. But in the process of rolling back that authority, the agency also diminished its oversight over broadband and internet service providers generally. And I think, you know, in this pandemic, It's not a great idea. We're all using these services to keep up with our day-to-day lives, and finding out that the communications authority in this country has less authority than it used to oversee internet service providers is not especially helpful. I'd like to see the FCC revisit those things, but at the moment I got an agency that is shy one member, and this is a hard issue to push forward on. But again, we're looking at data caps. We're looking at ways under existing rules we can start fixing these issues faster, mm-hmm. and especially any kind of abuses that happen for consumers mm-hmm. where they signed up for a plan that says they get a certain amount of service, and then they are told that that service is not available.
So when we talk more about, helping consumers with internet service providers and the cost of plans moving forward, I mean, what do you think is your first priority as acting chairwoman beyond getting this, the data mapping, the right data before the federal government?
I think getting this emergency broadband benefit program up and running. It would be the biggest program to assist households in this country with broadband affordability has ever existed. And we want to make sure that we get the word out about it. Consumers who may be struggling during this pandemic know about it and can sign up easily and swiftly. So the Emergency Broadband Benefit Program is first among all of our priorities, because I think it can do a lot of good connecting households that might be struggling right now, are having a hard time trying to figure out how they're going to pay their broadband bill and also put groceries on the table.
The former administration, net neutrality was repealed. Moving forward, the argument was that a lot would happen with that repeal, and it didn't come to be. But are you worried that there's been instances where we've seen ISPs, internet service providers, throttling service, and this is still an issue that you want to tackle moving forward once you get that full FCC membership?
Well, I'd like to make sure that the FCC has authority over broadband. Like with net neutrality, that was pushed back by the last administration. And I think what's important to keep in mind is that many households only have one provider available where they live. So if that provider starts blocking websites or censoring content or throttling certain services online, that household doesn't have a choice. They can't pick up take their business elsewhere. So I do believe net neutrality policies are important. And I also think that the companies and the providers of broadband are definitely on their best behavior. They're keenly aware that legislation passed the House last year to bring back net neutrality, that there are states like California that have enacted their own net neutrality laws. So I'd say that the providers are being very careful. And I think that that is something to do with the experience that we all have right now. But I also believe that having these policies on our books is a good thing. And either through the FCC or through Congress, I hope it's something that we could put into the law again.
I'm glad you brought up California, because this anecdote I'm going to share, what happened in California might get our listeners pretty incensed. But in 2018, firefighters there were fighting California fires. They were put in the slow lane by Verizon when they needed it the most. I mean, that's an example of, I mean, it's just amazing that happened.
Right. No, well, you also think, like, the choices that your providers make, maybe they'll throttle your cat videos or, you know, when you're sitting back and streaming online one night. But this is just a hefty reminder that these are services that are used in public safety, used in lots of environments. And we've got to be really thoughtful about making sure everyone has access to what they need.
Before we end, I wanted to ask you about 5G technology. And, you know, there have been communities that are a little worried about this. Could you talk about 5G technology and what the build out will look like moving forward? Some of the challenges?
Well, 5G is just the next generation of wireless technology. We are in early days here with its deployment. It is building off of 4G, which is the current generation. It is expected to bring speeds as much as 100 times faster with much, much lower latency. So it will make possible not just technologies that we know of on our phones, but try to picture this wireless capability built into the world around us, into cars. It'll make lots of things that are viable because the speeds are so much greater. and the latency is so reduced. I think that there's a lot of potential for use in the economy going forward. And we are just starting to explore that use. I recognize there's also some RF-related concerns, radio frequency-related concerns, and the FCC reviewed some of those issues the year before last. That review was under consideration by the courts, and it's something we'll be mindful of going forward.
When we talk about 5G technology, you know, how to make it more equitable, so not only serving wealthy communities like we have here in our state, the Fairfield County area, but what about rural and low-income areas?
Well, this is the challenge with all new technologies. You know, private sector companies are logically going to want to deploy it in the densest locations where there is the greatest economic opportunity first. And then the hope is that we can build it out to everyone everywhere. But instead of just, you know, hoping about it, we can also make policy choices that expedite that deployment by compelling wireless licensees to build not just to population, but to geographic areas, by providing support through universal service funds, and by working with states and cities to make sure that they have reasonable rules in place to help assist with that deployment, because that infrastructure is going to be really important for the next generation economy in every town and every community across this country. So I think we've got to look at all of those tools we have to improve policy to help its deployment and make sure it reaches everyone everywhere.
And what role does the FCC have in maybe upping what counts as broadband? I think, what is it, 25
yes,
megabits
right.
per second? That doesn't work for life in the pandemic.
No, I think I've been complaining about this for so long. So now I've got the opportunity to try to change it. Our current broadband standard is 25 megabits download, 3 megabits upload. I think it is high time to change that standard. I hope to be able to convince my colleagues to do so. You know, as a nation, when we set big goals, we get big things done. And I think at a minimum, it should be 100 megabits downstream as table stakes for every household right now. And we got to work towards that goal. If it's out of reach, then we got to find ways to be able to reach it and make it happen. But we should have a bigger goal than a 25 megabit standard. I think that standard has been in place now for 5 years. It's time to update it and upgrade it.
I want to thank Jessica Rosen-Worsell for joining us here on Where We Live. Again, she's acting chairwoman of the Federal Communications Commission. She also hosts a podcast. Can you tell us briefly, our listeners, about the podcast?
Sure. Well, you know, for a while I've been the only woman serving at the Federal Communications Commission, and I'm keenly aware that the number of women in STEM fields is too few. So I decided that rather than, you know, playing the sad trombone about that, we were going to just amplify the voices of some of the women I've been able to meet to learn about the technology that they work on. So I've been able to interview some huge dynamos. I've talked to senators about this, members of Congress. I've also spoken to folks like the head of the Girl Scouts, who's an engineer by training. I've spoken to an astronaut. And I just think it starts expanding our view of what women are doing in technology. And that's a good thing, because if people can see it, I think they can be it. And that was the whole purpose of starting the podcast. And I'm glad I've done so.
Well, thank you again for joining us. And we'll be watching to see what happens with the FCC, including, again, your acting chairwoman of the FCC, if appointed as the permanent chair. You would be the first chairwoman of the FCC, Jessica?
Yes, that would be the first permanent chairwoman in more than 8 decades. Yes.
Well, thank you again for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're listening back to my February conversation with West Hartford native Jessica Rosen-Worsell. She's the acting chairwoman of the FCC. I spoke with her about the Emergency Broadband Benefit Program, which Congress funded in the December 2020 COVID stimulus bill. As we discussed, the FCC was tasked with implementing this program, which will give low-income families discounts to make broadband access affordable in the pandemic. Earlier this week, the FCC announced it would begin testing the program with broadband providers. Consumers are not yet able to sign up for the benefit, but according to the FCC's website, the public should be able to sign up for the program by the end of April. Now, coming up, I speak with a Wall Street Journal reporter who covers tech policy. Stay with us. This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. We just heard from Jessica Rosenworcel, acting chairwoman of the Federal Communications Commission, for more about the FCC and some challenges ahead. Joining us now on Zoom, Ryan Tracy, tech policy reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Hi, Ryan.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming on today. So could you respond to Chairwoman Rosenworcel's interview, starting with broadband access? I asked her about the FCC auction under the former administration to companies to help expand broadband service. She didn't want to talk specifically about SpaceX, but I know this is something that you've covered, just the different types of technologies that that these companies hope to use to help expand broadband internet. Can you give us an overview?
Sure. Yeah. So this is kind of the other, you did a great job of outlining, you know, one problem is affordability. The other problem is access. And there are large parts of America that don't even have a provider offering broadband right now. So under the Trump administration, the FCC did an auction, the results of which were announced at the end of last year, that is going to be about $9 or $10 billion over the next 10 years that will subsidize providers to build out these networks in rural areas. And it's interesting now, Democrats are going to be in charge of deciding whether to sort of press the button and release that money. And there are some questions. There's a lot of lobbying going on in Washington about this right now, because some of the winners of the auction are providers that have less of a track record than some of the kind of household name type companies like, Charter, for example, which runs the Spectrum broadband product. SpaceX has never really had a widely available commercial service before, and yet it's in line to receive about $800 million over 10 years. So the question before the FCC now is whether it's okay with that, or is it confident that SpaceX can do what it's promising to do? And there are some other companies, even smaller than SpaceX, that are on the hook for some pretty large commitments. And so she's going to be kind of overseeing the staff that evaluate those applications. And the stakes there are, you know, if the FCC gives money to companies and they don't follow through, well, then it could be an even longer wait until it can set up another auction and send even more money to using somebody else to actually follow through. So, you know, you're talking about years of delay for some of these rural areas if those commitments don't work. On the other hand, you know, these are areas that are really hard to reach. Mm-hmm. And if it does work, if SpaceX does follow through, that's going to be great for those areas. So we'll see how it goes.
So SpaceX, again, would be satellite-based broadband service. Is this promising when we think about the challenges in rural areas, this last mile cost and pull challenges where internet service providers haven't wanted to spend the money to put in the infrastructure? Could this be a promising technology for those areas?
Yeah, I think it'd be hard to debate, your description of it as promising, right? the SpaceX technology is really interesting. It uses satellites that are much closer to the ground than satellites would typically be. And there's a lot more of them. There's a whole constellation of them. And you know, we're talking thousands of satellites, much smaller and closer to the ground. And the idea basically is that SpaceX can offer this technology all over the world to all sorts of areas that don't currently have, you know, a fiber optic cable going by their house right now. Because it's a new technology, though, you have all these questions. Well, how fast will it be? We know how fast the fiber line is, and we're not sure yet, you know, once you get, if you would get a lot of people signing up, will that sort of slow down the speed on these satellites? What happens when it rains? You know, all these things that once you deploy the technology at scale, that's really how you kind of learn how it works. So, you know, SpaceX obviously has done testing and they feel very confident that this is going to work, but you know, it's never really been done before. So we'll have to see.
I like focusing on this when we think about the billions of dollars in federal subsidies these companies are getting, because as you pointed out in one of your stories, these subsidies come from the so-called universal service fees that consumers see on their phone bills, Ryan.
Right, yeah. So this is a program that's been around a long time, and the idea was, you know, if the phone company gets a monopoly in a given area, well, you know, they ought to have the obligation of providing universal service in that area. And now we're kind of trying to adapt that program to the age of the internet, when you've got a lot more providers, internet service providers involved, and you're trying to kind of, you know, the Congress hasn't really updated the laws to reflect the fact that we're in this new kind of broadband age. The Universal Service Program is an old program, and what Chairwoman Rosenworcel and others at the FCC have done is try to adapt those fees and use them as funding for broadband programs. And, you know, there's all sorts of problems with that. One thing that's happening with those fees is they keep going up every year because fewer people are paying phone bills. And a lot of those bills are, you know, and that fee is on your phone bill. So there's less money available to try to build out broadband. And that's why Congress is appropriating additional funds, as we heard with this emergency program during the pandemic.
Again, it remains to be seen if acting chairwoman Jessica Rosenworcel becomes the permanent chair. But can you talk a little bit about the tenure of former FCC chairman Ajit Pai and what remains in front of her and the FCC in terms of his legacy and some of the things he did, including the repeal of net neutrality?
Yeah, so, you know, certainly she's got to deal with these broadband programs that we've talked about. Net neutrality is an issue where there's a really big partisan divide. Democrats think the FCC should be putting rules in place, regulating internet service providers and telling them, you know, not to sort of put one, not to throttle certain web traffic and allow other web traffic through, and really being very much more specific than Republicans would prefer in terms of regulations. And the Obama administration adopted net neutrality rules. The Trump administration rolled those back. Now we've got Democrats in charge, and they may eventually try to put them in place again. So we're kind of seesawing here. And, you know, she's obviously got, you could tell, I think, from the interview, she would love to be able to move forward tomorrow with reinstituting net neutrality rules, but she doesn't have the votes to do that right now. And so that's not going to be at the top of the agenda.
You're hearing Ryan Tracy, tech policy reporter at the Wall Street Journal, on Where We Live. Coming up after a short break, we're going to talk about, should government regulate the internet? And what does that mean for tech companies like Google and Amazon? We'll be back after a short break. This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil, broadcasting remotely. My guest right now on Zoom, Ryan Tracy, tech policy reporter at the Wall Street Journal. At the top of the show, we heard from acting chairwoman of the FCC, Jessica Rosenworcel. We brought up internet service providers and the speed that is considered broadband, Ryan. As she mentioned, she'd love to see that upped, I think, to 100 megabits per second. How possible would that be?
Yeah, so, you know, this is something that the FCC looks at when it gives out money for broadband. And the definition is important when, you know, you're talking about what level of service is the government going to subsidize. I think it is somewhat symbolic, though. So, for example, under the Trump administration, although the definition was 25 megabits per second, the money that they are planning to give out to provide service in all these rural areas that we've been talking about, a lot of that money is supposed to fund networks much, much faster than that, like 1,000 megabits per second or gigabit speed. And so, you know, the FCC is moving in the direction of kind of wanting to support faster service. And you know, it sounds like the acting chairwoman would like to, you know, also change the definition of what's considered broadband so that all these other programs, federal programs and federal policy in this area reflects that.
So we know that the FCC has a big hand in making rules around internet connection and service providers like Comcast and others. But what about regulating the internet in the sense of the enormous power tech companies have, like Google and Facebook and Amazon? Does the FCC have any say over this? And if not this agency, is there a move in Congress of having some more regulation of these tech companies?
Yeah, so this is one of the really kind of odd things about all the debate that the whole country is having right now about social media. And, you know, there's been these antitrust cases also against Google and Facebook filed at the end of last year. And, you know, there really is no agency that regulates the internet, right? There's and in particular regulates these huge, huge companies, really the biggest companies in the country right now. You know, big tech, so to speak. The Federal Communications Commission is an old agency, you know, created in the 1930s, and it doesn't have authority over Facebook or Google, really, unless they were to do something that the FCC regulates, like, for example, provide fiber broadband service or something like that. And so there's a kind of interesting policy debate going on right now in D.C., about what to do about that. Should Congress create a new agency? That's something that some Democrats, for example, have proposed. Or is that really the best thing? Maybe the internet's doing fine and we shouldn't have more regulation of it. And right now that debate is really kind of all over the place. Honestly, it's not as if Congress looks like it's getting ready to create a new internet regulator tomorrow. There's a lot of proposals floating out there right now, and a lot of debate. The one place where there is agreement is both Democrats and Republicans really don't feel great about where we are. You know, they're both angry for different reasons at Facebook and Google, and they're not content with the current situation. And so they've got to try to figure out a way to move forward with some policies to address that. And that's going to be tough, especially when Congress has so much else to do right now, when you're thinking about, you know, the coronavirus and economic recovery bill and all these other priorities that the president and leaders in Congress have set out. So, you know, it's a messy debate right now.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned whether there should be more or less regulations during the Trump administration. There was some movement on a law called Section 230. So this would be whether companies have protection from being held liable. Can you talk a little bit about how the Trump administration waded into this and what that means for the current FCC?
Yeah, so Section 230 is part of a law called the Communications Decency Act. It was created in 1996 at the beginning of the internet age, really. And it says that if, you know, for example, Twitter allows me to post a tweet that someone else says is defamatory, that person can't sue Twitter. They have to sue me, right? Twitter's not responsible for what I post there. And, you know, there are some other aspects to Section 230 as well, but that's kind of the basic thing. And that allows a lot of internet websites that host user-generated content to exist. So think of YouTube videos or reviews on TripAdvisor or, you know, postings on Airbnb or Amazon. The fact that the companies that are running those websites don't have liability for the content really allows them to run those websites. Otherwise, they'd be, you know, looking at lawsuits left and right all the time. So there's some logic to Section 230, and that's why it was created. But Section 230 has also become a target because there's this feeling, again, among policymakers that these companies just have too much leeway, that, you know, Twitter can decide to block someone completely, like it did with President Trump, if they want to. Or, you know, companies can decide not to block something, like when Facebook decided to leave up a video about House Speaker Nancy Pelosi that decision made a lot of Democrats really angry. So, you know, there's a lot of debate. Well, what should we do about this? We should look at Section 230. And in fact, President Biden has proposed revoking Section 230 altogether. He actually did that before President Trump proposed doing it. So this is something Biden and Trump both said they wanted to do. And it's unlikely, I think, that Congress is going to revoke the law altogether, because there's just not a lot of support for that. So the question is, what do you do? And that's something we're going to see a lot of hearings on this year in D.C. is how do you change this law if you're going to change it, to maybe bring some more accountability to these large social media platforms without hurting all these other websites or making them, you know, face a whole lot of lawsuits.
Well, I appreciate the context you provided for us. Ryan Tracy, tech policy reporter at The Wall Street Journal. We'll tweet out some links to his stories. It's been an interesting hour, and we'll be looking forward to seeing what happens with the FCC, including if Jessica Rosen-Worsell is made permanent chair. Ryan Tracy, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Today's show was produced by Carmen Baskoff. Our technical producer is Kat Pastor. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. As always, thanks for listening.